Yes, I'm happy to be able to introduce Susan Moon, who's not a stranger to many of us, who's been with us many times before in person. Susan is a longtime Zen student and received lay teaching entrustment. I don't know, some time ago. I was there for the ceremony. I think it was in the early 2000s or late 2000s or mid 2000s, something like that. But she received that entrustment from Norman Fisher. And she is a writer, an editor, has a lot of titles under her belt at this point. And together with Florence Kaplow, published, I think, one of the really the seminal books of so far of our Buddhist books of the century, which is The Hidden Lamp, stories of from 25 centuries of awakened women. And so this book really, we've studied it in this Sangha, and we've studied some of the stories and talked about that book in various configurations. And it's really brought out this important history and forgotten or not collected, at least, history of women teachers through the centuries. So that was a great service that Susan and Florence did for, I think, the Buddhist community in North America and elsewhere around the world. So let's see. Oh, but the other thing I have to say is that Susan is on the board of the Buddhist Election Retreat, and has, together with her compatriots on that, in that organization, developed a process that resulted in 25,000 letters being sent to voters in swing states across the country, urging them to get out to vote. A great service to our country and our democracy. So thank you so much, Susan, for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Jim, for that lovely introduction. You were at some of those letter writing retreats, were you not?
I was at some the phone banking. I kind of did the letter writing on my own.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did do letter writing, yes.
Yeah. And you did some of our, you were very important in our canvassing retreats 2 years ago, the last election. Yeah.
As were several others in our Sangha.
Yes. Well, thank you all for that. That's great. Now, just tell me, when does my part of the time end? You end at 8:30?
Around 8:30.
That's a long time away. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, so there'll be plenty of time for some questions, because I'm not going to be talking till then.
Okay.
Well, it's really nice to be here. And you know, I feel such a connection with you and Karen. I've known you before, before Valley Streams was, when it was Iron Bell. I knew you before it was, and you started Iron Bell. I knew you a long time ago and through Green Gulch and stuff. So I just feel like we're really old time Dharma brothers and sisters, and it's been nice to get to know some of the people in your Sangha too. So, and a funny thing about this Zoom meeting is that I know I'm not there in Sacramento because I'm sitting here in Berkeley, but I still keep thinking and imagining that all of you are sitting in the Dharma Center in Sacramento in that room where I've been with you before. And it's just that me, I have to be here remotely, and then I get to see you all in your own home. So maybe in spirit, we're all in that room or something. We're all in the Dharma room anyway. Well, so I want to talk about equanimity tonight. And it's a quality that comes in handy these days. And it's a quality that I don't usually pay a lot of attention to, but recent events have brought it to my attention. And I wanted to tell you of how I came to think about, or when I came to think of talking to you about it tonight. So in the events, and in the weeks leading up to the election, I was anxious and agitated, and I tried to be calm, and I was generally able to be calm, but I didn't feel calm, and I wanted to find equanimity. And I do want to say sort of out front here that I admit that I have been very eager to get Trump out of office, and I have been working toward that end. And I don't know whether there are any Trump supporters in this sangha. It's possible. And if there are, I just want to say that I hope that you will still be able to relate to some of the things that I'm talking about, because I think everyone was anxious about this election. And from my point of view, Trump's values contradict our precepts, and he's fostered violence and hatred and fear. But I was just talking to a friend of mine, a dear friend, whose niece is a devout Catholic and who's a very sort of righteous young woman and kind and loving to her family and everything. And she voted for Trump. And I said, "What, really?" And Mary said, "Well, yeah, she did. She held her nose and voted for Trump because she feels so strongly about abortion, against abortion. And she feels so strongly that it's wrong." And to her, to that woman, abortion is a serious violation of her commandment not to kill. So I just want to acknowledge that, well, that makes a certain amount of sense to me in a way. And I want to say that, you know, there's some gray areas here. And so I don't want to be divisive, but I do have to talk from my own point of view and my own feelings and my own experience. And that even if nobody in this room voted for Trump, I'm sure there are people here who are in all of these rooms. There are people here who love somebody who voted for Trump. So it's a big issue of how we can work together in what's become so polarized in our country. And that's another issue. That's not what I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm talking about equanimity, and I'm talking about my own experience. And so anyway, I was getting increasingly anxious and eager for the election to be over. And then on Tuesday evening, as the returns were starting to come in, Trump had an early lead in a number of states that the Democrats needed to win. And I was frightened. I was getting really frightened and imagining, could it be 2016 all over again? Could I survive? Anyway, I went to bed anxious and I slept. And then, as you all know, in the next few days, the tally gradually swung more and more toward the Democrats, and my anxiety diminished as the days went by, although I was still waiting. On Saturday morning, I was sitting at my desk when I saw the news on my computer that Biden had won Pennsylvania and thus the election. Then I heard people outside the house. I live on a residential street in Berkeley, and I heard people outside whooping and banging on pots. And I grabbed a handbell I have on my altar, and I ran outside insofar as I'm still able to run. And I stood in front of my house, and I rang the bell, and I hollered along with some of my neighbors, and I was shouting, "Yay, yay!" And I found myself shouting, "Yay for democracy! Hooray for democracy!" at the top of my lungs. And I was crying for joy. And I was amazed at how elated I felt and how charged up I felt and how happy I felt and relieved. And then suddenly I also had the thought, wait a minute, is this equanimity? What about equanimity? And I've noticed that when I'm upset by negative emotions, then I want equanimity. But when I'm jumping for joy, I'm not longing for more equanimity. And so should I be? So this made me think, well, this is something I'd like to explore further with you guys. And, you know, is there a way that this joy could be included in equanimity? And in this case, out in the street with my neighbors on Saturday morning, I continued to ring my bell and whoop for joy. My enthusiasm was not dampened by these questions, but I want to explore them further with you. So We're coming to the end of a pretty remarkable year, and 2020 in general has not been a year to foster equanimity. It's been a year, though, that has invited us to learn to practice equanimity. Let's just tick some things off. We started off learning, continuing to learn that we're ever more deeply mired in the climate crisis, and that in February, the largest glacier calving ever happened in Antarctica, I think. Then in March, of course, COVID-19 arrived and the shutdown began and our lives were completely upended. And for many, more than our schedules and our requirements to stay at home were upended, for many there was illness and death and economic crisis and joblessness and hunger. And that's still going on 8 months later, 8 months later. And in May, there was the police killing of George Floyd, which led to widespread, huge demonstrations, as you know, led by Black Lives Matter. And there was a sort of heightened awareness of the violence of white supremacy, and a window opened during which time white people really listened to Black people speaking of their experience of racism, which seemed very important. That was a really positive change. But then there were more police killings and more conversation about the violence of white supremacy, more calls for justice. And even so, the violence still continues. The police killings have continued. So there's that. And then while all this was going on, some of us were having to decide between whether to demonstrate for racial justice or stay inside to be safe from COVID. The fires came along in the West and in August and September and October, and some of them are still burning. Biggest wildfires ever. And I Can't Breathe took on a second meaning. In other parts of the country and the world, there were other extreme weather events associated with climate change. And these also continue. And Hurricane Eta is still lashing Florida. And this is the biggest hurricane season ever, more hurricanes in one season than there ever have been. And there have been huge floods. And all of this time too, there's been the ongoing stress of the election and worry about violence around the election and cataclysmic political events like the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So it's been a year of great tragedy and grief for many, and for the lucky ones among us like me, it's been still a year of tremendous worry and stress and the feeling that the ground is disappearing under our feet. So I hope I didn't make you too depressed by that list. We're all still here. And we're practicing and we're sitting together. That's great. That's wonderful. And some of these changes are good. And now, of course, we have this wonderful news. This election is over. To me, wonderful news. And I suspect to you, and that we are going to get a new administration. So things change and it's not all downhill, but it's a time, the times are more and more times when we really could use some understanding of equanimity. So what is equanimity? And in common speech, it's a state of mind, a calm, even-tempered state of mind, according to the dictionary. In Buddhism, equanimity is a kind of big ticket item. It's one of the four things in one of the important lists of Buddhism's many lists. It's one of the four immeasurables, they're called, also called the four heavenly abodes. And the four heavenly abodes are karuna, or compassion, metta, or loving kindness, mudita, or sympathetic joy, and upekkha, or equanimity. And in Vipassana practice, they put a lot of emphasis on these four immeasurables, the four heavenly abodes. I know at Spirit Rock, they have four dormitories, and the names of the four buildings are karuna, metta, mudita, and upekkha. When I was looking up online, getting ready for the talk, and I was looking up Dharma talks about equanimity, and I couldn't really find any by any talks specifically about equanimity by Zen teachers, but there are about a million talks on equanimity by Vipassana teachers. So there is, in Zen, I think we pay a little more attention generally to compassion and loving kindness. And sympathetic joy maybe gets a little less attention, and equanimity maybe gets even less attention than that. I don't know. And in a way, for me, I think equanimity is the least appealing initially. It used to be, because it's the least interesting, it's the least juicy. It sounds a little boring, maybe. And I think that's maybe one reason I haven't paid that much attention to it. It's more exciting to think about getting all upset or ranting and raving and or jumping for joy, to think about those things and consider what you can do about them and how you can work with them. And equanimity sounds kind of neutral or bland or neither here nor there. But this is a misunderstanding of it, of course. And I want to tell you a story about what something that might look like equanimity but isn't equanimity. My mother married her second husband late in her life, and he was a good companion for her. He was a retired English professor, a patient, imperturbable man, very gentle and smart. And my mother was a passionate and creative and generous natured person, but she was prone to outbursts of emotion. And Albert, my stepfather, used to kind of drive her crazy. He was so imperturbable. And one time I was visiting them in Chicago, and we were going to go out for dinner to some local restaurant. My mother suggested a couple of restaurants that she thought were good and wanted some feedback from me and Albert on where we should go. But I hadn't been there and I didn't know. And I recused myself. And she said, well, asked Albert, well, where would you like to go? And he just was noncommittal, and he kept saying, oh, it doesn't matter to me. And she kept asking him, and he said, oh, you decide, I don't care. And finally, my mother suddenly burst out, care, care. And she had a point. You know, she certainly wasn't practicing equanimity, but really neither was Albert. And she needed him to care about where they were going to go out to dinner. And the near enemy of equanimity is indifference. And Albert was really basically expressing indifference. And equanimity, I think true equanimity includes caring. It's the foundation for the other three heavenly abodes in a way. And it makes them possible. Compassion, loving kindness, and sympathetic joy are able to arise. There's space for them to arise when one is in a state of equanimity. I said that 2020 has been a year of feeling as if the ground is disappearing under our feet, but it isn't really disappearing under, the ground is not disappearing under our feet, because equanimity is that ground. That's what equanimity is. It holds us up. It supports us in meeting whatever we do meet. It's a foundation. I don't know if you use ever Maile Scott's metta prayer in your sangha. Do you ever say that, Jim? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I had to unmute. No, we haven't adopted that, although I did enjoy saying it during the election retreat.
Well, it's a beautiful sort of version of the metta prayer, metta sutta. But anyway, a couple of lines in it say, may I be at ease in my body. May I be at ease in my body, feeling the ground beneath my seat and feet, aware of my breath as it rises and falls and rises. So I think that's, she's just saying that's equanimity, but I think that is equanimity, feeling the ground beneath my seat and feet. At ease in my body, feeling the ground beneath my seat and feet. There's a related list in Buddhist teachings which is related to equanimity, and that list is the list of the eight worldly winds. Now, if you're ever, you're kind of a compulsive person who likes to make lists, Buddhism is a great practice for you. I'm a great list maker. I'm not that I ever do everything on the list, but I like to make lists. Anyway, Buddhism likes to make lists too. But one of the lists is the eight worldly winds. And these are four pairs of things that are kind of changes of fortune that keep blowing us one way and then another, like the wind. And the eight worldly winds are pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. So they're kind of polar opposites, pairs of things. And we will be continue to be blown by these winds as long as we live. They are constantly blowing us one way or the other. So, for example, right now I'm relieved about the results of the election and I'm feeling kind of a little bit calm, but in a couple of months I may be very upset again about the results of the Georgia Senate race, or somebody you love moves away and then maybe they move back, or somebody's diagnosed with cancer, then they have remission, then the cancer comes back, or you rent a place and a year later your landlord tells you to move out for their daughter to move in. So these things just keep happening in our lives. And equanimity takes us beyond these dualities. It's not that we're going to get away from them and that these winds are not going to blow for us. Their change is the nature of life is change. But equanimity can help us stay grounded in this kind of time. And it has room for pleasure and pain. But it's not neutral. It's warm. It's loving. I feel like equanimity says to you, you are Buddha. You have Buddha nature. You're not separate. You're not alone. And you're held by the universe. And this is one way I practice equanimity, is by remembering that I'm part of the vastness of the universe. The eight winds, the swings from loss to gain and back again, they kind of lose their power over me when I look up at the moon waxing and waning in its beautiful rhythms, regardless of who's the president. And far beyond the moon and beyond the sun and beyond the solar system, it seems a miracle to me that I can see with these small eyes in these tiny little circles in my head, I can see huge and distant stars like Deneb, which is the tail of Cygnus the swan and is the brightest star it's the farthest star that we can see in our galaxy. And it's about 2,500 light years away. So when I'm looking at the star Deneb in the Milky Way galaxy, the Deneb that I'm looking at is the one that existed 2,500 years ago. And if someone was on Deneb looking back in my direction, in our direction, they wouldn't see me because I haven't been born yet right now from the point of view of Deneb. And but if that person on Deneb had a really, really powerful telescope, what they might see if they could look at the earth is Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree 2,500 years ago. That's what they would see. So this is also miraculous that it makes my troubles seem kind of small. And I look up at the galaxy and I think, thank you, universe, for letting me be part of you, for letting me witness you wheeling around me. What a miracle. And the Ojibwe Indians say, sometimes I go about pitying myself while all the while I'm being carried by great winds across the sky. So that's a kind of equanimity practice I have. Then coming back down to earth, I want to talk about another very different and much more immediate way that I try to foster equanimity. And one of the teachings that I most appreciate in Buddhism that's meant the most to me over my years of practice is the teaching of not turning away from what's difficult, which is a constant practice to keep working on. And equanimity helps me to meet what's in front of me without judging or analyzing, but just with full attention, being fully there. And so equanimity helps me do that. And when I do that, when I meet what's in front of me wholeheartedly, that fosters equanimity. So it kind of goes both directions. Because if my whole heart is in the meeting, then there's really no room left over inside of me for worrying if I'm really wholehearted. In Annie Dillard's book, The Writing Life, she tells this wonderful story about taking a walk in the woods by herself. And she comes face to face sort of suddenly on the path with a weasel. And she says they stood still and they looked at each other. And she was surprised that the weasel didn't run away in fear. She wasn't really afraid of the weasel. I mean, she was a little nervous, but the weasel stopped and it just stood there and they looked at each other. They just looked at each other as if the weasel was saying, what is this? Who is this? Who's there? Just looking. And then she wrote, Annie Dillard wrote, I would like to live as the weasel lives, choosing the given with a fierce and pointed will. And I just love this sentence. I wrote it on a card and it sits on my desk. Excuse me. So choosing, the idea of choosing what's given, I didn't choose it before it was given. I didn't say, please give me this, but I got it. And then I choose it after it's given to me. I can still choose it. So the sentence again is, I would like to live as the weasel lives, choosing the given with a fierce and pointed will. And this reminds me too of a chant, a vow, a prayer that I learned from a friend at Zen Center of Los Angeles that apparently they use in their services. And it goes like this. It's called Liberation from All Obstructions in appreciation of Shodo Harada Roshi. In the presence of Sangha, in the light of Dharma, in oneness with Buddha, may my path to complete enlightenment benefit everyone. In this passing moment, karma ripens and all things come to be. I vow to affirm what is. If there's cost, I choose to pay. If there's need, I choose to give. If there's pain, I choose to feel. If there's sorrow, I choose to grieve. When burning, I choose heat. When calm, I choose peace. When starving, I choose hunger. When happy, I choose joy. Whom I encounter, I choose to meet. What I shoulder, I choose to bear. When it's my birth, I choose to live. When it's my death, I choose to die. Where this takes me, I choose to go. Being with what is, I respond to what is. I vow to choose this Dharma entrance gate. May all Buddhas and wise ones help me live this vow. So, I think I'll add one further thought, which is to talk about an experience directly related to our Buddhist practice. On Wednesday, the day after Election Day, I went to a demonstration in downtown Oakland with the same group of people that's kind of come up as a community around organizing these election retreats. We went to this demonstration. It was had been organized to speak to protect the vote and to make sure the votes were counted. And so we had planned ahead of time to go. And we had a big banner that said, count every vote. And we went to downtown Oakland and we took our zafus and we sat in silence under the banner. And the demonstration was small and very peaceful. And sitting in silence together certainly helped to foster equanimity, but and we were we were still anxious. Nothing had been declared. Nothing was completely clear. And it helped us to have some equanimity. And I think it fosters equanimity for everyone at a demonstration, just to see people sitting in silence. And this is especially the case if there's agitation and a threat of violence at a demonstration, which was not happening at all on Wednesday. This was a small and peaceful demonstration. So in a sense, we didn't really need to be there to offer that embodiment. And we also didn't really need to be there to say, count the votes, because it turned out that the votes were being counted. It was going quite smoothly. So that was great. But still, it felt good to be in Sangha together there. But there are other times in the past when I was working for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and the Buddhist Peace Fellowship used to organize to sit at demonstrations. And we would go to demonstrations, peace demonstrations or whatever, and take our zafus with us. And what was particularly moving to me were we would go to demonstrations at anti-death penalty demonstrations and rallies at San Quentin prison for a couple of hours before midnight on the terrible night of an execution. So people would be speaking from the stage against the death penalty, and they were very crowded, these demonstrations, in a small space. It was very loud and agitated, and people were upset, and there was always, well, maybe there's the governor is going to, 5 minutes before midnight, maybe the governor will grant clemency or some judge will decide. I mean, it was often, there were these down to the wire things. And the guards would be standing shoulder to shoulder across the entrance gate with their full riot gear on, and they were doing their job. They weren't being violent. They were just standing there, though, with their arms crossed, looking kind of ominous. And then there was almost always some pro-death penalty sort of counter-demonstrators there shouting and saying, this guy's a criminal, he's got to die and stuff. So it was a quite a tense and upsetting situation. And in those times, I just felt so good to be sitting on the ground on a zafu, kind of knee to knee, pressed in close with my fellows there. And we made a little sort of pool at a meadow of lower elevation people sitting there. So we were visible. And I think it really added something to the demonstration. I think just seeing people sitting like that in silence makes a difference. And when people were, if somebody's shouting and yelling at somebody else, and then they kind of stumble against and bump into you, and they look down and there you are sitting there, and they sort of get embarrassed. Oh, I'm sorry. And think, well, wait, what's this? What is this? There's a kind of cognitive dissonance almost that makes other people stop and maybe take an extra breath. I don't know. Anyway, it's not just to prove anything to other people. It's just to be there yourself for embodying this feeling of equanimity, for feeling the ground beneath my seat and feet, as Meili said. Feeling aware of the breath as it rises and falls and rises. And so I just mentioned this because this is what we have, as we have this practice as Zen practitioners, as Buddhists, in the coming days and the turbulent times that are bound to come sooner or later, and with the eight winds blowing us to and fro. We have our Zazen practice. We can sit together. We can sit together in public parks. We can sit together on Zoom, each in our own space, as we just did tonight. We can sit by ourselves at home or outdoors in the backyard or next to a river. But even sitting alone, we can know that we are sitting with the whole universe as we sit, and that we're steadying each other, and we're trying to steady the whole universe and feel this some steadiness underneath it all for ourselves. So I think that our practice can really help us to establish a sense of equanimity and to share that as best we can with others. It's a kind of contagious thing. Another thing that just comes to mind right this minute is Thich Nhat Hanh speaking about how in the days of people fleeing Vietnam and the boat people fleeing, he gave an example of if a boat is leaving, is on the water and it's boarded by pirates, as sometimes happened, and it's turbulent and there's upheaval, or if it's just in a storm, if there's one person on the boat who's really calm and settled and grounded, that, I don't know if you can be grounded on a boat, watered. Anyway, if there's one person who's really calm, that can spread out. So we all have access to that. We have access to that immeasurable, and we can foster it in ourselves, and we can know that the possibility of it is there for us, and there's that foundation under us, whether we feel it or not somehow. So, oh, and I just want to go back to the beginning to say, because I didn't quite directly answer my own question about, well, is screaming and yelling for joy and ringing my bell, how does that fit with equanimity? And I think that it fits. I think equanimity does and can include that, right? Because if I take equanimity as this sense of foundation or of the ground, then as long as you're feeling that there's some ground there, if you're expressing joy and you're shouting and even ringing a bell loudly, that doesn't take away equanimity. That can be included in equanimity. It's when you really are lost and you lose that sense of groundedness, that's where equanimity comes in. That's where we need to find it and help each other find it. So I'll stop there, and I'm hoping that people will have some comments to make. We've got 15 minutes to go. Or thoughts or any experiences you've had with or without equanimity, or questions, or
yes, I'd like to say something. Yes, Clem, I've met you before.
So I remember you, Clem. Hi, nice to see you.
The thought that comes to mind after your talk for me is, to me, equanimity seems like it is the realization of the serenity prayer. You know, the ability to accept the things we can't change, the courage to change the things we can, and hopefully the wisdom to know the difference.
I think that's a great observation. That's a great way to think about equanimity. Yeah, because the courage to change the things we can is sort of the part where I was talking about meeting what's really there wholeheartedly and being present with it. And the part about accepting what you can't change, I don't know, maybe that sort of connects too with just being part of the universe and the stars and everything. Anyway, I think that's a great thought.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. It's a very helpful prayer. Does anybody have any stories to tell about losing and gaining equanimity, or what helps you to have equanimity in trying times? Or what do you do to calm down, just in a simple way? What do you do to calm down when you get really upset or anxious?
Well, I have a story.
Yeah.
We were at the time you were hearing that news and ringing the bell, we were just starting a half day sitting on Saturday.
Oh.
And Kenny, who was our Doan, told us the news on the very edge of the beginning of our sitting.
Oh my God.
That Pennsylvania had been called. And so we were perfectly positioned for equanimity in the face of this news, because we were just going to sit and we weren't going to be dissuaded from our practice of still sitting by that news.
He shared the news.
He shared the news. Yes, he shared the news. But we were right, essentially, right as he was going to ring the opening bell for the sitting. So there was no space to ring a bell. But then I talked to my friend Eleanor Howe. I bet you know Eleanor, and she's in North Carolina, and she told me that when she heard the news, she went out in her yard and rang a big bell that they have in front of their house. So I think you weren't alone in expressing equanimity and with bell ringing.
Yeah. Well, apparently the bells of Notre Dame were ringing like mad in Paris on Saturday.
Oh, really? Wow.
When they heard the news. But Jim, I think that's great. That must have been a great Zazen period that everybody had. They must have sat with a really good kind of equanimity.
I hope so.
Yeah, Doralee.
Well, it just reminds me, I heard this story about a village in Sri Lanka when the tsunami hit and so many villages, were destroyed and many people were killed. And there was one village where a lot of the parents had been killed. And so there were all these like orphan children sort of lost wandering around. And this one boy, he would go into the center of the village and he just started singing a song, but the song was the story of what happened.
Oh, wow.
And then the children would come and they would kind of sit there. And every day he would come and he would sing the same song of what actually happened, talking about being present with what is. And then after, several weeks of this kind of ritual, the children came and then they started singing the song too.
Wow.
All singing it together. And it's just, it just speaks to what you're talking about, the power of that kind of capacity, no matter what's happening.
Wow.
That reminds me of the cellist of Sarajevo. Who sat in the streets.
Tell that story, please.
It was a man who, in the middle of where they were destroying Sarajevo and shooting at one another and the resistance, and it was horrible. He would come out and sit in the middle of one crossroads every day and play and brought this different sense of what could be.
Yeah.
And bullets soaring over his head and everything else. It's a beautiful story.
It is a beautiful story.
But that reminds me of that, Doralee.
And what about in your own lives? Have some of you had moments where you found an unexpected source of equanimity or a way to find some serenity in the midst of chaos?
I'll share a story.
Yeah, thank you.
I was a physician. I was an anesthesiologist, and I had a perfectionist streak in me, and I really wanted to become a very good one. And so I did a fellowship in pediatric anesthesiology, but 1 month shy of my completion of that 1 year program, I was asked to leave that fellowship back in 2003. At that time, my daughter was 4 years old and my son was 3 months old. And so, rather humiliated and dejected and rejected, I did see an opportunity of becoming a stay-at-home parent. By coincidence, our au pair from Poland, within the very same 24 hours of my being asked to leave my fellowship, declared that she was pregnant and was going within 24 hours back to Poland.
Oh my God.
So we lost an au pair and got a father. You know, we did a trade within 24 hours, and I got to be the stay-at-home dad for two children who are now 21 and 17.
Wow, fantastic.
And it was really, yeah, I mean, it, and it's almost, you know, again, gone back the other way, because my wife, who is now my ex-wife, another physician, somebody I met in medical school, was frankly, you know, just a little over envious or jealous of the fact that I got to spend so much time with the children. And so, you know, post divorce, you know, it's like, okay, she's got them now. And the tide goes this way and that way. But I did have 14 years with them, raising them. And one of the great things I got to do as a four-year-old, when I was 4 years old in 1969 and 70, my parents had a Winnebago, and we drove around the perimeter of the United States, down into Guatemala and up into Alaska. We had a canoe on the top of the Winnebago and a little 80cc motorbike, and we were just outdoors for the whole year. We were camping, and, you know, I smell smoke in a campground, or the smell of porridge with butter and maple syrup. It just brings me right back to that trip. And I got to mimic that trip a bit with drives across the country. My mother, father, sister, they all still live in Vermont. And so I would drive to New England every summer with my kids in the back seat. And we would just do a lot of miles, not talking, but just looking out the window and driving somewhat faster than I would like to admit on I-80 to get to the Northeast. But we had a lot of good times outdoors, essentially, crossing the country. Lastly, I do want to just say it was 4 years ago today that Hillary conceded to Donald Trump, and I was getting into a moving van to drive back west and had 3 days of NPR going, oh my God, I can't believe what we have to deal with now. And within a month, I attended your letter writing workshop in November of 16, as well as Heather Sundberg, I think, correct me if I'm saying her name wrong, but she gave us an equanimity talk. And great. I have had this on my bathroom wall. I just pulled it off to display, you know, just saying that, yes, you know, it's a valuable thing. I am going to just say, I don't think celebrating celebrating the win of Joe and Kamala is equanimity, but then again, when I eat a muffin, you know, I want some salt, some sugar and whatnot. And so even though it's not equanimity, I'll just say equanimity is like salt, and I'll say joy and compassion's like sugar. And I just, there's other, they are components. And so our behavior doesn't have to be perfectly exhibiting something salty all the time. You know, it's a flow. I'm just going to leave it at that. Thank you for listening.
Well, thank you. That's a good example too of choosing the given, you know, that idea of choosing what was given to you. You chose it. You became a father, stay-at-home dad, and as if that was just what you wanted to choose, and it became what you wanted to do. And then, yeah, that's a great story. Also, I don't think that shouting for joy is equanimity, but I think equanimity holds it. I think equanimity is bigger than that and can contain it. That can be included in equanimity somehow. Anyway, that was very nice. Thank you. Does somebody else want to offer something? It's great. I can't see all of you at once, so if you
I'll tell a brief story about one of the first Dokusan's interviews I ever had as a budding Zen student was with Ed Brown. And I said to him, all I'm really looking for is equanimity. And his response was, be careful what you ask for. And I, being a new Zen student, I didn't realize that I could come back and say, you know,
what do you mean?
What do you mean? Or, you know, but it was a koan, you know, it became a koan. Yeah, be careful what you ask for.
Where does it, did it take you anywhere? Did you
I think in general, it's in general, I think I'm fairly calm. And when you ask, what do you do, you know, to to calm yourself, that would be breathing. I mean, just coming back to the breath is where I go. But I it also made me think of when bad things happen, I'm usually in my best moment. And I don't know where that comes from. But when I woke up from a colonoscopy and they weren't taking me to the recovery room, rather they were taking me to get a scan, I knew immediately what they found. And I knew immediately I had a tumor, you know. You just know, because otherwise you go to the recovery room, you put your clothes back on and you, you know, everything's fine. And a friend of mine was there, a very dear friend of mine was there, and she's got tears in her eyes, you know, when the doctor said, yes, it's a tumor. And I just said, it's okay. Mm-hmm. We will do what we need to do. And I think I'll be fine. But, you know, we'll just do what we need to do. That's all, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea why I was that calm. Mm-hmm. At that moment, and stayed pretty, you know, through the treatment and everything. I was proud of myself.
I don't blame you. I'm proud of you too.
And everything's fine. So good. So far. So yeah, those moments in my life that I've, you know, kind of risen to the occasion. I think I once again have to thank my family, my parents.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Linda. And I guess we need to stop now. Yes, Jim, it's 8:30. But I just want to say that you're different, the different things that you've shared make just underline the fact that we so often have more access to these helpful states of mind than we even know, or, you know, in times of need we can, as you use the expression, rise to the occasion. We can find our foundation, we can find the ground under our feet, and we can find a source of equanimity within us, because that's really where it is. And you were, all of you, talking about that. So thank you very much. I enjoyed being here with you.
Well, thank you so much, Susan.
You're welcome.
I don't know, made me think of Obama, because, you know, he was like the most equanimous person that probably has ever led the country, you know, and he just, the power that he had, I really think a lot of it came from that, you know, it came from his evenness.
And Jim, he didn't just appear to be that way. He was that way. I mean, I've met him in Illinois many times before he became on the national stage, and he exuded that when he walked into a room. He could change the mood of a room like that, and then he'd smile, and everybody went melted.
He had a great smile. Has a great smile.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. Well, let me just ask you something completely petty that I should have asked at the beginning, but it's out of curiosity for myself going forward. Is my sound okay? Can you hear me all right?
Yeah. Yeah, we hear you fine.
I'm loud enough?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Before you go on,
we would have told you if it was a miss.
I wanted to mention that Biden has some of those same qualities. There was a video of him talking to parents of kids that were killed. And he was just saying he was sorry to all of these. And this little boy comes running up to him and he says, you know, I'm a victim too. One of my parents was killed. And Biden just takes him in his arms.
Wow.
And says, are you okay? And then at this point you realize this little kid has Down syndrome. And the little kid goes, no, I'm not okay, which I thought was just wonderful. And Biden just wraps him up even tighter. And he says, it's okay. You'll be okay. Mm-hmm. You'll just be okay. I'm going, that's exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
And he certainly demonstrates compassion really well. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan.
We go out.